that's been on my mind for many years, actually. A long, long time ago, it seems now. I did some experiments with Pseudomonas populations, common or garden bacteria, doesn't particularly matter their name or identity. These experiments were done in laboratory microcosms, test tubes effectively, and unshaken test tubes. These bacteria, when they go into unshaken test tubes, experience strong diversifying selection and they radiate. In essence, one sees a miniature adaptive radiation. Now, one of the dominant types that emerges during this radiation is a type that colonizes the air-liquid interface. And it does so by virtue of cooperating among the individual cells that are of the genotype that colonizes this air-liquid interface. So what we have, and I'll show you some pictures and some real-time videos of this in a minute, what we have then, or in this experiment, was the evolution of simple undifferentiated cooperating groups. And I became particularly interested in how these groups might subsequently evolve or participate in the process of evolution by natural selection. And again, over the years, I did various experiments with these groups that you might consider standard group selection experiments. And I saw indeed that it was relatively easy to select for the best groups, but I had to decide what the best groups were. These could have been the strongest groups, the thickest groups, the brightest colored groups, it doesn't matter. I chose what those groups were, and there was no opportunity for open-ended evolution, which is what I was looking for. I wanted these groups to be Darwinian individuals, and they weren't, at least at the outset of these experiments. And this presented something of a dilemma to me, which over the years has gone on to become something of an obsession. It's been a lot of fun. So the work here owes much, a huge amount, to Catherine Hammerschmidt and Caroline Rose, a postdoc and PhD student respectively, who have just gone well beyond the call of duty in this work. I said to a couple of people that had I realized what would have been involved in proposing this project, I never would have proposed this work in the outset, because it's an inhumane amount of work to have got through what they've done. We're talking probably upward of 100,000 microcosms manipulated. It pains me even to think about what they've done. Truly saints. Eric Libby is a mathematician, and Yuri Pishigin as well, mathematicians. They've done a lot of work on the theoretical underpinnings of what's going on here, but I won't work on that today. And Ben Kerr, a long-standing friend and colleague, who's also been instrumental in the development of some of these ideas. So we start off with concepts that have already been very well introduced during the course of this meeting. And Alan Clark, in particular, spoke about concepts of organisms and individuality, so cast your mind back to her talk. But Darwinian individuality could be a property of any set of entities that vary, that reproduce at different rates, and inherit some of this variation. So variation, reproduction, and heredity. Critical for entities to participate in evolutionary processes. In fact, any set of entities that has variation, reproduction, and heredity will participate in evolution by natural selection, whether it likes it or not, whether it's biotic or whether it's abiotic. And what we know and can envisage even from first principles is that individuality in this Darwinian sense exists at multiple levels of biological organization. So to make this painfully obvious, here's a red dot, it's an individual entity, it reproduces, the offspring resemble the parents, every now and then there is a mutation. By virtue of there being variation, capacity to reproduce, and the variation that affects fitness being heritable, this population of entities will evolve. So that should yellow have an advantage in terms of its capacity to leave offspring, it will sweep through this population. Now that exact same principle applies to collectives of cells, okay, provided those collectives have the same heritable variance in fitness. So here we have two higher level entities, they're made up of collectives this time. Once again, we get a variant type emerging, and that would sweep through. It was favored by selection. Now, a critical issue that, I've heard a number of people mention over the last days, is that thinking about adaptation at a particular level, we need to recognize that selection needs to act at the level which is the level that is appropriate. So if we are wishing to invoke adaptations at the group level, it must be necessary for that group, that collective of entities, to participate in the process of evolution by natural selection. That requires these collectives here to have the essential properties of Darwinian individuality. That is variation, reproduction, and heredity. Now, during the evolution of life, there have been a number of major transitions in individuality, essential for the evolution of life's complexity, in fact. During these evolutionary transitions, we've gone from, before the transition, selection acting on individual entities that have variation, reproduction, and heredity, to, after the transition is made, collectives of entities that, again, have these essential properties of Darwinian individuality. Now, the causes in these shifts are far from clear, and in fact, they pose, I think, a really profound problem. It's not obvious, for example, let's say we're thinking about the evolution of multicellular organisms from individual cells, why, in a world that's simply replete with individual cells that are all units of selection, that are all doing just fine, why some of these would give up their right to autonomous replication and come to replicate as part of a corporate body. I mean, why would they do that? And in the case of a multicellular organism, the vast majority of cells are our soma, and soma is essentially an evolutionary dead end. So from one perspective, if we're thinking in terms of the evolution from single cell to multicellular collectives, it really is a profound paradox. Almost the grandest trick of nature, if you like, to have brought about this transition in which these individual entities have largely foregone their own right to autonomous replication. So there's that question, why would autonomously replicating entities sacrifice their individuality? Now that way of asking this question rather suggests that there is a drive from the lower level entities for the entities themselves to give up their reproductive capacity. It's perhaps more useful to ask it from this perspective. How does a population of cells, so asking it from the level of the collective or the level of the group, become a single entity capable of leaving of collective level reproduction? But one way or another, however you pose the question, it's a profound problem. Many of you have probably read John Maynard Smith, Ersat Nari's book, Major Evolutionary Transitions, that was published in 1995, and are familiar with the basic concept here. So these evolutionary transitions in Darwinian individuality have taken place multiple times. This is just a set of six. There have undoubtedly been many others. But each of these transitions have gone from, or has involved a transition from individual entities, for example, self-replicating chemistries, to collectives of self-replicating chemistries that are in this case compartmentalized. Separate prokaryotic cells that were individually units of selection to eukaryotes, which are a collective. Single cells here, in the case of the evolution to multicellularity, which makes some sort of transition to multicellular groups, where in each case, entities that worked or were free agents or single agents before the transition come to replicate either solely or at least in part of the collective after the transition is complete. So the particular focus for the rest of the day is at least conceptually the transition from single cells to multicellularity. And it's very much an experimentally driven view, driven out of curiosity over how we might coerce these newly evolved, undifferentiated groups to participate in evolution by natural selection at the level of the collective. So I introduced, but in only a very general sense, this multi-level selection framework. You can largely ignore it if it means nothing to you. What I've got is a series of slides which depict in very general and simple terms what we think happens during an evolutionary transition, such as that from single cells, indicated here as plus signs, to multicellular groups. So we could think of the first stage, which is often referred to as being in MLS1 territory, and I'll say more about that in a moment, with a set of individual entities that are Darwinian individuals, part of Darwinian populations, directed on by evolutionary processes, in particular by selection. Mutations arise. Every now and then a mutation might arise that confers on, in this case, this red cross, the capacity to cooperate, or clump, at least, in the simplest sense. So here we have a clump of cells that, where these individual cells have somehow aligned their interests, wrought quite possibly and most likely, in my, the way I think about this, by natural selection itself. It won't always be costly to be part of a group, even if there's no obvious benefit to be part of that group. I say that because if cells are clumped together, they will be competing more intensely than usual for resources. They will also be excreting metabolites, toxic waste products into their immediate environment. It's highly likely that if you're to get, or we are ever to see groups emerge, that there is some benefit to being part of that group that offsets the costs to being that group. And you'll see in the example I mentioned in a moment, there is a very clear benefit to being part of a group despite a very clear cost. So we might say, using some jargon here, that the cost of being part of this group are traded against some enhanced benefit that accrues from being a member of this group. Okay, that's all very straightforward, it's all very fine. Such initial stages in the evolution of cooperation are readily achievable. However, no sooner have we seen the emergence of a simple, undifferentiated group of cells, selection will continue to act at the level of the lower entities. Because it's costly to be part of this group, selection will favor types that defect, that cheat from being, That is, types that benefit back from being part of the group, but which pay none of the costs. And those cheaters will become numerous, and they will ultimately destroy the fabric of the group. So this leads us to the next conceptual stage in terms of our wander through stages to multicellularity, when we come up against, very early on, the problem of conflict and cheating. So natural selection takes us to this first simple undifferentiated group, but no sooner, that has it established this group, then selection sets up the conditions for the emergence of defecting types. And in the absence of some way of controlling defecting types, we're back to square one. So that's led many to suggest that the next stages involve the evolution of some forms of policing or punishment system that prevent the capacity of cheating types to disrupt the emerging cooperating group. But as I'm going to question throughout this talk, I'm not sure that more cooperation and less cheating is the answer. And in fact, I think in terms of evolutionary transitions, while cooperation is absolutely essential, I don't believe you get a transition without cooperation, there's something more to it than just cooperation. Okay, so now we move into what's known as MLS2 territory, and again, I'll explain this with a cartoon that will come up at the bottom of the slide in a moment. But now we really get into an area that is grey, to put it mildly. So here are individual entities. We got our emergent group, which was destroyed by defectors. The next stage is the emergence of collectives that beget collectives. So at this stage here, when we're thinking about collectives begetting collectives, we are very much in this MLS2 territory. However, if you think about this, particularly from a mechanistic perspective, at this stage we've got no end of problems that need solving. And en route to this stage, it would seem that we need to evolve, at the very least, a means by which the collective reproduces. It very often will involve some germ soma separation, development differentiation, some means of distinguishing self from other, and some means of punishment. Now, these traits are arguably traits that are the product of selection acting at the level of the collective. They could not be argued as simple byproducts of selection acting at the lower level. So that places us in a dilemma. Let's just think about reproduction itself. We cannot invoke reproduction as both cause and effect. It makes no sense to say the evolution of reproduction is caused by the evolution of reproduction. These kinds of properties require an evolutionary explanation. the way I presented it here, it would appear that these kinds of properties can't evolve until we have already evolved individuality at this higher level. And something is clearly missing. So what goes on during this stage is a puzzle. Individuality would seem to emerge here, but would appear to be required at this point here. Oh, yes, of course.
In this Hume's collective where you already said there wasn't really...
At the loose collective level, there wouldn't be any great gain, nor would there be any particular cost. I mean, it would be sort of neutral, but they would cohere together. So at that level, one would assume that cheating wouldn't really offer too much benefit on any individual.
Absolutely. If there's no benefit, except if there's no benefit by being...
amount of benefit, but not a very clear cost to any anyone at the expense of any other. But my question is, when you say, the connection is getting difficult, already at the collective stage, don't you have a different situation with respect to the size, physical scale, and also the temporal scales involved in the reproduction? I mean, one would think once that thing is an individual, it's not going to be multiplying at the rate that the single cells are. So you have a change of length and time scales coming in, which probably changes the picture.
The last words were changes?
It changes the picture already.
One thing I should emphasize too, I mean, yes, those are perfectly valid, valuable thoughts. There are many different possible solutions to this kind of problem here. And I should also add that multicellularity has evolved independently around 20, 25 times, some people argue. Yeah. So there are many possible routes through this dilemma. And as Alan mentioned the other day, individuality comes in all sorts of flavors or degrees of individuality, from paradigm populations where variation, heredity, and reproduction are cut and dried, clear cut, you know, where there's a very clear distinction between parent and offspring and so on, and other areas where it's much less clear cut, where reproduction is a fuzzy thing as far as we would see it today. Here I'm very much thinking about things being wrought by selection, in part that's my experimental perspective, and I want to do experiments on this as well. So I need things to happen, and so I need all the help from selection that I possibly could get. So this concept of fitness decoupling, that was just made there, that we wouldn't expect these collectives to reproduce at the same rate as the individual entities that make them up, is absolutely true. In fact, during this stage, when we go from simple undifferentiated groups to collectives that can beget collectives, we would expect the fitness of the collective to become uncoupled to the fitness of the lower level entities. And here's a little schematic to make this clear. So, from this point back, we're in what's known as MLS1, multi-level selection 1, theoretical territory, where the fitness of the collectives is no more than the sum or average, depending on how you wish to calculate it, of the number of entities that make up the collective. So this collective here and this collective, let's imagine they were founded at exactly the same point in time. At T plus 1, there are many more individual entities in this collective than there are in this collective. This collective is the fitter collective. Its fitness is simply determined by the lower level entities. After this transition has been effected, this is no longer the case. So here are these two entities we just considered. At this stage, collectives beget collectives, and although this collective is made comprised of just 9 lower level entities and this of 16, this collective leaves 2 copies in the same time that leaves just 1. So from an MLS2 perspective, this is the fitter group. And here you can see that fitness of the higher level is decoupled from that of the lower level. And indeed we would expect this. There's no sense that elephants, by virtue of having more cells in their body than mice, leave more offspring than mice. fitness decoupling seems to be a fact of life. Logically, it makes sense. Actually, from a theoretical perspective, it's not required. However, it is highly unlikely, particularly for any organism that goes through a bottleneck at reproduction stage, that you would get anything other than fitness decoupling. So this is what I think is a central issue, and that is to bridge understanding of cooperation, definitely important, for the evolution of simple groups, with the emergence of groups that are capable of differential reproduction. So if you just sit back and think about that, you know, how do you think you might bridge this kind of understanding? We need cooperation, and yet we need our cooperating groups to have evolved, or to evolve the capacity for reproduction. Now, the way we've tended to think about this is you just select more on cooperation, more on cooperation, more on cooperation, you solve the problem of cheating. But what about the capacity of groups to begate groups? It doesn't follow logically, in fact, that just because you select on cooperation, you evolve groups that have the capacity to begate groups. It seems to me there is something missing here. So again, we've got cooperating groups, but somehow we need to get our groups to the stage where our groups beget group offspring. So, here's what I'm selling. What if selection could act directly on some primitive form of reproduction at the higher level? Well, obviously, if the collectives, these newly emergent groups, had some proto-capacity to leave offspring, and you could select on them, then you would be away. No doubt about it. It might seem an impossibility, but looking at our experimental populations, it's not. And I can see in other situations, this is what I'm going to suggest to you, is not an altogether impossible situation. What we see in our experimental populations, and I'll develop this much more fully in light of these experiments in a moment, is some kind of a rudimentary life cycle that emerges quite spontaneously, if you like, for free, between levels of selection. So what we would like, and at least I would like, in order to see the evolution of these kinds of things, is for individuality to emerge here. Some proto, if our primordial groups had some capacity to enter into Darwinian processes at the higher level here, we would be largely home and hosed. So, I'm suggesting a life cycle could emerge at this stage from tensions between levels of selection. So there we get our cooperating group that we saw earlier on. We had a red plus here and it gave our cooperating group. Well, what we know is that that cooperating group will be destroyed by cheats. But if those cheats could give rise again to a cooperating group, and those cooperating groups gave rise to cheats again, and those cheats in turn gave rise to cooperating groups, then we would have something analogous to a very, very primitive life cycle, but nonetheless, primitive life cycle. And by virtue of such a cycle, selection could act directly on this property, if you like, of an organism. So the next part, I'll take you through some experiments that I hope give substance to both this idea that we could have a tension between levels of selection driving a proto-life cycle, and then an experiment where we actually see whether selection can act on this proto-life cycle and see where that gets us. So a little introduction to these Pseudomonas populations. I'll take you through real-time evolution, cooperation, and conflict so you can see this life cycle. And again, the idea that I'm selling here is that this tension between the interests of the group, which sets up conditions that favor the evolution of the cheat, which sets up conditions that favor the evolution of the group again, it's in, to all intents and purposes, a rudimentary life cycle upon which selection could work. So we don't need any details about these experimental populations other than to say this bacterium is nothing special, you could go out onto the leaves and get it from the gardens out here. But what we see repeatedly when we allow the ancestral type, which has a smooth colony morphology and grows in the broth, to grow, we see repeatedly many different types emerge out the other side. The one that's the attention of my interest here is this wrinkly spreader colony, which looks like that on a solid agar plate surface, but forms a mat at the air-liquid interface. Now, what you can barely see, but I will explain on the left-hand side here, is a plot of depth into one of these vials and oxygen saturation along the x-axis. And I have this here to make the point that when this broth colonizing type grows in the broth, it rapidly, within the space of 12 to 18 hours, depletes completely all of the oxygen from this environment. These bacteria need oxygen. The depletion of this oxygen sets up conditions that favor evolution of these wrinkly spreader cell types. Now, these wrinkly spreader cell types, they produce a glue, they stick together, it's a cellulosic polymer, the mutations of literally hundreds of different types underpinning this have been identified, and all of the connections from DNA sequence through to various protein changes to give rise to these mats have been well documented. I can tell you much more than that about that if you wished, or provide you with references. So these mutants arise very easily, readily, they have a selective advantage, and they do so despite a considerable cost. That's what I meant to say. So they produce the cellulose. Cellulose is a polymer of glucose. Glucose is food, but these cells are spitting out a large amount of their food, turning it into a polymer that allows the cells to stick together. This mat is not buoyant. It sticks here by virtue of the adherent properties of the individual cells. In fact, there are two types of glues. There's a cellulose glue that sticks cells to each other, and there's a proteinaceous glue that is important and required to stick the cells to the glass. So these cells truly work together to achieve something that individual cells acting alone cannot achieve, and that is occupancy of a new niche. And in occupying this niche, they have access to a plentiful supply of oxygen, which is otherwise denied to cells that live in the growth phase. So here's a schematic of that. Here is a microcosm, the meniscus, the ancestral cell, divides by binary fission. Sooner or later, a wrinkly spreader cell arises, and somehow or another it gets to the air liquid interface. These cells are motile, so too is the wrinkly spreader cell, although it is less able to express motility because it holds itself to its clone mates by this glue. These individual cells are highly motile, and that's important. Once at the meniscus, these spread rapidly across the air liquid interface. In effectively a single layer, the cellulose is produced by the cell pole, so each time the cell divides, they spread across the surface. They glue themselves to the outer vial. Once that happens, the mat begins to thicken. It can become a very substantive structure of several millimeters in depth. The cells underneath are deprived of oxygen. These cells up here, despite the cost, reap a benefit by being part of this group. But that, of course, sets up the conditions that favor the evolution of cheating types. Oh, and I have this in here to show if you are uncomfortable with the idea that bacteria could cooperate, you can think about this as being no different than an ant bridge. Cells are individually working together with no cognitive capacity here whatsoever, we would believe, to achieve, again, something that cells acting alone cannot achieve.
Isn't this the same as biochemistry?
You could call it that. I wouldn't. Well, I would make a big distinction. I would make a distinction. A big distinction between, you could call that a biofilm. Oh, the question, is that a biofilm? And my response was, you could call it a biofilm, but I would make a big distinction between a biofilm that forms on a solid surface and one that forms at the air-liquid interface in this instance. Growing at a surface could simply be the consequence of growth and cell division. Here, there is a measurable cost to being the mat-forming cell, and you can see that there is very clearly a collective benefit that is cause of the success and not just a consequence of the success.
Many labs consider this as a biofilm.
But I'm not denying that this is a biofilm, yeah. But there are different kinds of biofilms. And again, if that was a pellicle that floated as opposed to one that is suspended, I would also say, from my perspective, it's nowhere near as interesting. It would not necessarily count as an instance of the evolution of cooperation. So I'm selling this as an example of the evolution of cooperation on the basis that I can watch it evolve repeatedly, of course, under these ecological conditions, and therefore I can go in and test various hypotheses about this. One is I can measure the cost of overproducing the glue. I can see that it's costly. I can also show that the collective of cells benefits by producing this glue.
And if you do simple mechanical disruption of the diffusion at the glass,
Yeah.
Will the rest of the cells survive?
Well, what happens...
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Yeah, so the question was, what happens if you disrupt the cells from the glass?
Contact with the glass.
Yes, if you gently prod, as you have some nice pictures, but not here, if you take a glass rod and just very gently poke the... dislodge the cells from the edge here, the mat just sinks down to the bottom very quickly, and the cells then die on the bottom because they suffer from anoxia. The other thing that you can do, which draws attention to some other property of this collective, is that you can vortex the cells for 30 seconds and then put them leave the tube on the bench, and the mat doesn't reassemble itself. In fact, you can take 10 to the 9 cells of that wrinkly spreader type and put them into one microcosm, or you can take one cell and put it into the microcosm, and the rate at which the mat will re-establish is exactly the same. And that's saying something different, but it's telling us that the property of forming this mat involves a process, a simple process of development.
So if you have quite a thick mat...
Just a second, especially with the noise out there.
If you have quite a thick mat, then yeah. Do all of the wrinkly cells get the same amount of oxygen, or is there...
Well, no. The ones underneath would definitely be starved of oxygen. Yeah, for sure. A major gradient across that, actually.
So those are the atrophic ones. The ones at the bottom are the atrophic ones then, or...?
Well, I wouldn't use the word altruistic. I would say they are cooperating. I don't think they're doing it at cost to themselves. They are reaping a benefit. Selection is part rewarding this as a consequent or benefit conferred on the recipient cell. I don't think this is altruism.
But they're not benefiting as much as the ones at the top. That's
true. I mean, where you are within the mat is an important factor. But they don't know that.
If individual cells did not have a positive buoyancy, then your mat should form from the side, not from the center. No?
Yeah, it does a bit of both. The surface tension keeps them going, spreading along the right across the surface, so you can see that they follow the meniscus. But it does come in both ways. But you think it should not be able to...
I'm puzzled about the fact that it starts from the center. I mean, this to me would mean that you have some cells that are buoyant, positively buoyant, but maybe it's enough that they are there to reproduce and that's it.
Yeah, well, once... These cells are no means guaranteed of forming a mat, actually. It's quite a precarious business. Again, I'll show you a real-time video in a moment. So they will start, and in fact, what's got to happen is they've got to spread across the surface fast and make connection to the site. If they fail to do that, it just goes down, and you can see them sinking.
Can you make a film of cheetos and non-cheetos?
Can you make a film
of cheetos and non-cheetos being in the film together?
Yes, you can. I can just about hear the generators making a lot of noise.
Yeah, right. I think can the green pink cells make out whether there are any green? There is one green cell sticking there.
Oh yeah.
Can it make a full film itself?
I'll show you the next bit then. Maybe this answers. So what happens is within this mat, once you've got a substantive mat. And it's costing to be part of this mat, it sets the scene for the emergence of cheating types. So these cheating types, which will look like this, genetically they'll be different than the ancestor, can hitch a ride effectively within this mat. So they no longer produce the glue, they therefore grow more rapidly, they can take advantage of the fabric, they therefore reap the oxygen, but because they contribute nothing to the structure of the mat, they ultimately cause the demise of the mat. Now there's data that backs up all of this, it's published elsewhere. So just a graphical representation of that there. So we see here the evolution of cooperation, and then no sooner have we got cooperation, we see natural selection promoting the evolution of cheating types. And this is simply done by the ecological circumstances that are established by each genotype in turn. So here we have a movie, actually, this didn't used to have this demo thing on it, it's just come, even though I bought the software. Anyway, this is watch here, through the course of 4 days, inoculated with the mat forming type. And here you can see the establishment. thick substantive structure. Okay, now the next one that I will show you is founded from a cheating type. And I'm not sure if we better see it with the lighting being as it is, but you can actually see the de novo evolution of mats and then their demise in the space of about 4 days. Let's see, okay. So, colonization of the Baroque phase, and now there's a bit of a mat that fell away there, actually from the edge there, Sylvia. But you'll see, so again, this is the evolution of the mat-forming types from single mutant cells of this variety in a very short space of time. Oh, did you see it there, the whole, did you see the collapse there? Not too many nods, you did. Okay, well, in this very short space of time, we've gone from it being inoculated with a single genotype to the population size to getting around 10 to the 9, during which stage there are many, many different mutants. Selection favors those that produce this cellulosic polymer, and in this short space of time, they go from one cell to a population sufficiently substantive to colonize that air liquid interface and form the mat, and they therefore collapse once again. So we see the evolution of these cooperating groups, their demise by cheats, but their re-evolution and further demise. So again, we have the potential for this proto-developmental cycle. And I like to think of it as a life cycle for free, effectively, in that it does come from nothing other than the tensions between higher and lower levels of selection. And we don't have to contrive this. In this spatially structured environment, this could, in principle, cycle perpetually.
All the green ones, if I can simplistically put it, are the blue ones genetically different than the green ones?
Yes.
Or are they identical always?
No, they will almost all, they will always, I would say, be different. The genetic roots, and I touched upon this, but in a very different experiment that you kind of just let come into your mind and then put right out of your mind when I spoke last time. The capacity to go between these two types, well, it's extraordinary. There are, I would say hundreds of different mutational routes to go back and forward between these different states. So, of course, the capacity for this non-developmental cycle to begin with, but this life cycle to be the substrate for selection does require the capacity to transition between different phases. And to begin with, for sure, it's by mutation, spontaneous mutation, and they're different each time. So, yeah, the idea here is instead of trying to punish the cheats, which is how we've always thought of them, the notion here is that perhaps we could put cheats to work. This tension that exists within the system, maybe that could take us somewhere in terms of providing us with fuel to transition evolution. So, pushing things a little bit further, but at least providing a different way of conceptualizing things, there are parallels here between that sort of a protosoma, in that the wrinkly spreader mats are, at least the way we're looking at them in these experiments, essentially an evolutionary dead end. They have no capacity to reproduce themselves unless we are to intervene. So you could think of them as a soma, and the cheats as a kind of a germline. Proto, very rudimentary. But as I said before, perhaps there might be something that's of a higher level that selection could actually work on here. And that's what we see being feasible given this life cycle. And you know, from that, it's only a hop, skip, and a jump, and you're at a mouse. Now, the big difference between the developmental cycle here with the mouse and this one here is this is wrought initially by mutation. And all of the life cycles that we know about, even the most simplistic, in Myxococcus or Dictyostelium, for example, these life cycles are plastic wrought by developmental control. And there is absolutely no way that a life cycle like this could continue on being driven by mutation. It would absolutely have to come under developmental control. But the idea is, at least, maybe this would be enough to get us going. This, if we could end up, would be a wonderful thing. Now, I took all of this out for the interest of time, but again, there's a lovely cycling in this system. Feedbacks between organisms and their environments that fuel this cycle. So here is our SM type, or our swimming type, or our primitive propagule type, and here's our cooperating group, or our a wrinkly spreader mat. The names, of course, become problematic here. But anyway, our single cell, our collective. As the single cell type grows, it changes its environment, depletes oxygen, and shifts it to this green state. As it goes to this green state, the transition... So when this one grows, it brings about a shift in the environment which favors this genotype, the wrinkly spreader mat. This then changes the environment, which switches it back to an environment that favors the original type again. So there is a coupled feedback between the organisms and the environment. The different states of the environment are wrought by changes in the organisms, which will reap changes in the external state of the environment. So the system stands to cycle, and the properties of such an environment with this kind of feedback, this kind of niche construction, are particularly interesting. Yeah? So how does the wrinkly spreader type change its environment? It changes the environment by forming that mat. And by forming that mat, it provides the structure which now favors the evolution of the cheating types. So it's brought about a physical change, not just a chemical change in the environment. And so what happens then? So yes, there's no oxygen underneath at all, but by virtue of having that mat, the smooth types, the cheating types, can grow up in the mat. And they do very well, but then the mat collapses, and then the oxygen penetrates once again.
So it's kind of substrate?
Yes, yeah.
Unlimited glucose system? What about glucose?
No, it's a very nutritious medium. Now, of course, after about a week or so, nutrients become limiting. Actually, what becomes limiting more is the toxin, build up of toxic metabolites. But we don't keep these, I'll show you exactly how we run the experiment in a moment. But certainly over the first 5 to 7 days, oxygen is the only limiting resource. It becomes exceptionally limiting right off. Well, this more or less summarizes the previous slide. Of course, the life cycle by mutation is not plausible in the long term, but this clunky kind of cycle, a proto-developmental cycle, that is driven by mutation might just be enough to get things off the ground. Ultimately, the cycle must come under developmental control. But previous and some of our current work does give us reason to be optimistic, and I'll show you a slide on the next one that reminds you of what I spoke about last week. I think more limiting to bring about these kinds of transitions, at least with experimental conditions, are the ecological conditions that would underpin this transition. So I showed you this slide last week, and this experiment is not part of what I'm telling you about this week. Okay, so don't confuse it that way. But during this experiment, where we were selecting for genotypes to change their phenotype, and they were being forced to do this by going backward and forward between two different environments, we did, in one of these lines that I talked about, see early transitions between smooth and wrinkly, and smooth and wrinkly, and smooth and wrinkly, and smooth, and then it went to pop after this. Well, when I saw the results of these experiments some years ago, that gave me hope that this rudimentary life cycle could actually run for a little bit, in that spontaneous mutation could take you backward and forward between these different types. So there was hope, there was some optimism. Okay, so here are the two heroines. This is Caroline Rose and Katrin Hammerschmidt, who really had just done the most outstanding work. And this is just a tiny amount of what would be set up to run at any one point in time. Two really fantastic young scientists.
What is the size of the...
The microcosms are they're about 25 mils. They have they have 6 mils of broth in them. So, here's the life cycle. We've very much contrived this life cycle to make sure it plays out in this experiment. When we initially thought about doing this, I envisaged a very relaxed way of running this experiment, one where we didn't have to push it as hard as we had to push it at this stage. But in order to directly see the operation of this life cycle, we've needed to do it as I show you here. We're now at the stage where it would be in principle possible to relax this and do experiments as I've initially envisaged in large ponds, effectively, where these groups would compete with other groups without us having to intervene at all. Anyway, let me take you through the selection regime. So, this is the life cycle regime. It has two phases to it, phase one and phase two. Here is a single cell of the wrinkly group-forming type. It's placed into a microcosm and it's left for 6 days. At the end of 6 days, a sample is vortexed and a sample is taken and plated. And on those plates we can see the cooperating cells by virtue of their colony morphology, which is wrinkly, and cheating cells or propagule cells, which are smooth. At this stage, we would take the smooth cells, we take all of them, mix them together, and then use those to found phase two. During this phase, the propagules compete with one another. You could almost think of this as kind of a sperm competition phase. The competition is to be the first to produce the wrinkly spreader, the soma, once again. At the end of 3 days, we check to see whether there is any soma present, and then a single soma cell goes back around to found the next generation. And again, we approximate this life cycle. So there is a bottleneck, and there is a genetic distinctiveness between each phase of the life cycle. You could view this as an organism, and although I don't want to load things too much, it's kind of helpful to begin to think in these terms, because what goes on through this period of time is actually very complex, and it's part of the selective regime. Well, I already drew attention to this, but we can ignore that. So here is our start. Actually, I've switched the phases around, but it doesn't particularly matter. At this stage, we put the propagule into the vial here. It's got 3 days to produce the body of the organism. So the propagule success is completely dependent on production of soma during this 3 day period. So after 3 days, we check to see if there is any wrinkly spreader or soma-like cell. If there are, that's good. If there's not, the organism goes extinct. We would take one of these, a single most common type, and it's used to establish the organism. Now, to reproduce, this soma must produce propagules. And it must do so during this 6 day period. Now, these propagules, on one hand, well, let me put it around the other way. These non-wrinkly spreader types, when they first emerge, stand to destroy the group. We would look at them and we would say they're cheats. So they are, on one hand, the nemesis of the group, but they also stand to be potentially its savior, because at this point in time, if there are no propagules produced, there is no capacity for that group to beget group-level offspring. So the propagules are the nemesis of the group, on one perspective, but they're also its savior. So during this 6 day period, a successful organism maximizes its reproductive output. And there are different ways to achieve this. The rate of propagule production is a key issue, along with mat strength. But equally, the propagules that are produced at this stage must be capable of reproducing the soma when they're put around. A rather neat feature of this self-perpetuating system is that natural selection holds the propagule, or the cheat, responsible for both the good and the bad that it does. We end up with a kind of a self-policing system here for free. The organism dies day six, but the propagules are collected at this point in time, and they are then sent back around to re-establish the organism once again. Okay. Back to our life cycle. Now, to pass through this life cycle, it is obviously necessary to go through all the different phases. Extinction, as I say here, is everyday certainty. It's not an easy thing to transition through this life cycle. So, this organism that exists within this set of microcosms can go extinct if it fails to form a mat at day 6, at the end of the first day phase. There is no mat visible to us by eye. That organism is simply dead, and that's it. If it's produced no propagules at this stage, it is also dead and eliminated from the experiment. Similarly, if at the end of the three-day phase, the germline had failed to produce any infosoma once again, that organism is dead. If we perform an experiment now, where we have, our typical experiment involves racks containing 8 microcosms, and there are 15 racks of 8 microcosms. So if we have one of those experimental setups, and we just allow selection to run through within microcosms with no between microcosm selection, then we see rapid extinction of groups. So here's our experimental unit here. 8 microcosms in a single rack. There are 15 replicates of those 8 microcosms. So if we simply allow these 120 microcosms to run through this life cycle, weeding out those that go extinct due to failures at any of these three stages, then we see that by generation 7 times through this life cycle, there's been complete extinction of all 120 emergent organisms. So it gives you a sense of the challenge that these organisms face actually going through this proto life cycle. So in doing such an experiment, we're selecting purely on group viability. Group viability is not great in the long term. This shows you something of the dynamics of extinction. I find this quite fascinating, but I'll go through it very quickly. We start off with 120 microcosms. After the first generation, we've lost all but 39 due to failure. After the second step through, we're down to 15 microcosms. So it's very difficult for these organisms to make their way through this life cycle regime. So within group selection alone, we don't get anywhere. So we have a selection regime which allows competition between groups. Now, if we're to think of selection being able to operate at the collective level, then collectives need to be able to beget collectives. And those that are capable of leaving more collectives than others must be able to replace less successful ones. So that means some sort of between group selection. Now, we implemented between group selection in various ways. I'm telling you about just one here, which is in effect implementation via a Moran process. Where there is a death, there becomes an opportunity for a birth. Deaths occur by natural failures in the organisms to go through life cycles. At that stage, we allow reproduction of another type. So here's that life cycle, phase one, phase two. There could be a death due to failure, due to collapse of the mat at the end of the six-day period. In this case, this organism would be replaced by another. It would be replaced down here. There could be failure at this particular point in time here, in which case this organism would be replaced by another, and again we could have a failure here. So every time there was an extinction event, it provided an opportunity for a reproduction event. Now, two instances, this was entirely random, the choice of organism to succeed based on viability alone. At this stage up here, for experimental practicality only, we made the replacement based on fecundity. So if you are viable and can run through this life cycle, you have a chance of leaving more offspring. There is also an even a greater chance of you going on if you are more fecund than others. So here we have, in the selective regime, both within opportunity for within group selection, within a single organism, there is also between group selection by implementation of this Moran process. When there is a death, there is a birth. And here selection operates both within and between groups, and does so on a combination of group viability and group fecundity. Now, we also have a control effectively for the life cycle. It's exactly the same in every way as the life cycle regime. But it doesn't go through the bottleneck. Sorry, it goes through a bottleneck, but it doesn't go through the propagule phase. So instead of going from mat to propagule to mat, soma to mat to soma, we just go from mat to mat to mat. Each time it goes through a bottleneck, though. So we implement the same kind of within and between group selection but we no longer require the organisms to transition through the life cycle. How many of these? 15 racks of 8 tubes each, 120 for each treatment.
You have more than one extinction per...
Yeah. We typically have between 3 and 4 extinctions per rack, per generation, although they become less as time goes on. Okay, selection in this operates in exactly the same manner as it did before. So we've got two experimental regimes. The life cycle regime goes through this process, it goes through the selection regime, and then the control. Exactly the same, but it doesn't go through the life cycle. Now there are many implications actually of this difference. You could think of this as acting directly on cooperation itself. Might think, well, you know, we are definitely allowing between group selection, but the game here is probably going to be just getting better and better and better at growing well within the mat, the strongest mats. The deal is definitely very different over here, and I guess the experimental outcomes will give you a sense of that. So again, this is the number of racks just for one time through the experiment. We went through this 10 group generations, which doesn't sound like a long time, but believe me, it's horrendous, let alone all the work that's required after the experiment that's being done to take it apart. So, in order to understand the results of the experiment, I need to tell you just briefly about what we did after we finished the experiment. How did we measure fitness at a group level, and how did we measure fitness at a single cell level? Both measures of fitness matter. Well, there are many ways you could potentially do it. And how we got to these solutions is a long story in itself. But first, it's worth just conceptualizing in very general terms the experiment. Here's our life cycle and our control. They went 10 generations. We start off with an ancestral state at the beginning. We end up at the end of 10 generations with a set of derived lines. Again, there are 15 replicates of each of these racks that contain 8 microcosms. What we did is from each derived rack, 15 of them, from each of the two treatments, and from the ancestral state, we obtained a single representative wrinkly spreader cell that was representative of that rack. And I'll show you how we got that in a moment. So with that representative, we can then ask, how does that derived clone differ in fitness at the collective and also at the individual cell level relative to the ancestral type? Okay. Now, our ancestral type is actually not our ancestral type. We can't get that for experimental reasons. So we have what's known as our baseline populations, and you'll see why they are not exactly ancestral in a minute, but they are a wrinkly spreader that is as early in the life cycle as possible. And in fact, all of these competition experiments are highly conservative and stacked against these guys showing anything quite major. So here's how we choose this representative clone at the end of the experiment and also at the beginning of the experiment. So here are our 8 microcosms from a rack, let's say at the end of the experiment. We take each of the different wrinkly spreaders that are there, we allow them to form a mat at the end of 6 days. If there is a failure, that's simply eradicated. Those wrinkly spreaders are all mixed and they're plated. And at this stage, in the life cycle regime, we pick all of the smooth colonies. In the control, we pick all the wrinkly colonies, place them into a single vial, plate them all out, re-inoculate another set of microcosms, plate, and then we will take a single wrinkly spreader that is representative of the most abundant type out of all of those types. It's just a single type. Now you may think that we are losing a lot of information in doing this, and indeed we would be, but it simply becomes impractical to take every single microcosm and treat it on its own. Again, you know, we stack the odds against ourselves by doing this, potentially losing quite a lot of information, but it was the only practical way that we could proceed. So we do this to obtain derived clones from the life cycle treatment and also from the control treatment at the end of the experiment, and we also do it to get ourselves baseline data right at the start of the experiment. I'm not sure how much this is. Well, this is necessary. We could always go back to this if you wish later. How do we do our fitness assays? Well, we've got those representative clones, and we want to know of our derived clones, are they better at leaving? So we've got our groups, our derived groups. Are our derived groups better at leaving groups more fit in terms of their capacity to leave group level offspring relative to ancestral groups? So we need to be able to measure group level fecundity. We also want to be able to measure fecundity at the level of the individual cells that make up the group. So here's how we do it. We take that single representative clone from one rack, so there will be 15 of these for each treatment. And we inoculate it just as it would into 8 microcosms. We mix, we plate. We count the total number of cells here. This gives a measure of cell level fitness. We can measure the total number of wrinkly cells, of smooth cells. We can measure the rate of growth of these cells. We can actually take a variety of measurements, as I'll show you in a minute, of the lower level cell fitness. We then take all of the smooth propagules. So we form the soma. Now we've collected their reproductive output in this vial. At this stage, we take a genetically marked, a neutrally marked, absolute ancestral type, which is a free-swimming cell type. It's never been through this life cycle regime at all. And we mix them in a fixed ratio. If there are twice as many of these, well, we keep the ratios fixed, but if there are more cells or less cells at this stage, they are punished or rewarded by adjustment of the ratio competitively. We now inoculate the germ lines, if you like, into this vial, plate them out, and now we ask after 3 days how many groups are formed by our test clone and how many are formed by our competitor. And we will express that simply as a ratio. So it is as cut and dried as I show you down here. The first genotype that throws up a wrinkly spreader will ensure that the map that's formed is of a single genetic type. And so here we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 that are of this type, and there are 2 that are from this type. So we get a measure of collective fitness. This single clone has left, 1.5 times more offspring than we would expect if its fitness were equivalent. If the fitness were equivalent, there would be equal numbers of groups at this stage here. Yeah. Okay, we're nearly there. We do the same for the control. Okay. Perhaps we just get on to the data. There are a number of things that we would expect and predict based on theories. Perhaps the worst one thing to mention is bottlenecks and germlines that we've implemented in the selective regimes. They are thought to have important properties with regard to providing opportunities, endowing these populations with properties of Darwinian individuality. Okay, so what do we find finally? Well, here is a measure of group fitness relative to the baseline. And this is just in our control experiments. So these have gone mat to mat to mat to mat. And what we can see here is that the fitness of the control has gone up significantly from baseline in terms of its group level fitness. So that's good. We would expect this. After a period of evolution, group fitness has increased. If we look at a measure of cell fitness from the same populations, we see individual cell fitness has also increased in our control lines. And the fact that it's increased by about the same amount as has increased in the group fitness measurements largely suggests that increases in lower level fitness explain the fitness at the higher level. And that would more or less make sense. The way we've done that experiment could imagine the selection regime favoring wrinkly spreader cell types that grow better. If you grow better, you're more likely to be passed on. So cooperation here is a property of individual cells and its relevance within a group context. That the fitness of the collective would seem to be explained at the level of the individual cell. And indeed, that more or less is shown here. Here we have a measure of cell fitness, the number of wrinkly spreaders making up a mat, and measure group fitness. This is in our control. The baseline data are in gray, and the evolved are in blue. Now, highly significant positive correlations, but what you can see if you close your eyes is that the number of purple dots has basically been moved into the top right-hand corner, saying that the way that these populations have improved their group level fitness to improve their lower level cell performance. No sense of fitness decoupling. So group fitness and control is likely a byproduct of selecting and acting on cell level properties. And another way of thinking about this is that despite applying Darwinian individuality by virtue of the design of our experiment to these unique spreader groups, the focus of selection has remained on the maintenance of cooperation rather than on any emergent property of the collective. So again, this is consistent with what I was saying, which is that the fitness of the collective can be explained on the basis of the fitness of the lower level entities. Now that's quite different when we look at the life cycle treatment. So blue data points are what you saw just a moment ago. Let's look at the life cycle. Group fitness again has gone up. But this is the surprising thing. The cell fitness in the life cycle regime has gone down. Now you do not expect to see that. After selection through this long period of time, one expects things to have increased. It doesn't matter what measure of lower level cell fitness you take at this stage, lower level cell fitness has decreased. This, in and of itself, what it says, you cannot explain fitness of the collective on the basis of the fitness of the individual cells. There's some sort of emergence here, in the sense that you can't explain the fitness of the collective based on the fitness of the lower level. Okay, we're just about there. Now, that apparent instance of fitness decoupling.
Can I have one question? Comment this life cycle was it the measure that you were counting on the plates?
Yes, what we're doing there.
So that's what you're showing, that you count on the plates. We're doing like this, that the wind is spread and tends to group together, so you can count them as one.
You will underestimate that amount, but that would be the same for everyone. But I'll show you other measures of fitness. It doesn't matter if we do it on the basis of number of wrinkly spreaders, number of smooths, number of wrinkly spreaders and smooths, rate of growth and smooths. They're all down very significantly. This apparent instance of emergence or fitness decoupling definitely begs the question. May be that we cannot explain the fitness of the higher level based on the fitness measures of the lower level, but we must be able to account for it mechanistically at the lower cell. So, again, a huge amount of work went into basically exploring the life history evolution of these populations. This involved, for each of those 15 clones, for each of the different treatments, establishment for each day, a set of 3 microcosms. So, right from the outset, all of these microcosms were inoculated. Every day, a set of 3 would be destructively harvested and then would be sampled to do things like measures of wrinklies, measures of smooths, measures of transition probabilities, and so on. Okay, I just showed this so you get a sense of how to visualize the data. What we did here is we went, so the first phase is a 6-day phase. We went for 6 days and then we extended it twice, so we went on for 12 days. The next phase, we went for 3 days, extended it for 3 days. At each time point, getting the appropriate data. What we found is that the likelihood of producing the other type has significantly changed. So here are these days upon which we harvested these data. And this shows the proportion of microcosms with the new type. So if they started with the wrinkly, which is what they are here, then we can see that in the baseline, this is the rate at which they produce the new type. The derived lines, they're producing the new type much not accounted for at all by changes in total cell density. If anything, total cell density for most of the points is actually reduced in the derived lines. We can look at other properties too, and they're not helpful in explaining this. You can look here at the cell density of the new type or proportion of the new type the total. There is a big shift here in terms of the likelihood of producing the other type. So this is a heat map that links the likelihood of producing other types to group fitness. How to read this? So those three microcosms that were harvested every single day, we scored them for the presence of the opposite type. If there were no other types, then there is a white circle. If there is one of the three has a new type, pale red, slightly dark red, full-bodied red, if all three microcosms have the other type. These are ranked according to group fitness. Highest group fitness, lowest group fitness. 15 different replicates, these are 12 days of the life cycle, during phase 1 and phase 2. The main thing you can see is the groups that have the highest fitness in our baseline, should I tell you. So this is not our arrival, this is the baseline. So this is the starting material the selection worked on. The fittest groups were the ones that were most likely to generate the other type early. Here's our derived or our evolved lines. And you can see that these six or so lines that had high levels of red color in our baseline are now much extended. Most of this part of the chart is filled in with red colors. So there's been quite a significant shift in the rate at which new types are produced. Now, of course, there could be different reasons for this. And in fact, I will tell you in a moment that the reasons that these are up here has nothing to do with the reasons that these are up here, the underlying explanation difference. Now, what's the basis of the improvement in this capacity to produce the other type? There's two extreme possibilities. Either we see more of the other type because they grow faster, or we see more of the other type because the rate of transition has increased. What could be some mixture in between? So imagine we've got a tube here, and to begin with, we see one of the other types on day three. But after the experiment run, after the fitness experiment, after the selection experiments have been done, we now see other types right on day one. So that could be because the mutation rate has gone up, or some transition probability has gone up, or it could be just the ones that the mutation rate is exactly the same, the rate of growth of the new type is so much faster. And let's just skip to the chase. So, what we find, in fact, when we measure the rate of growth of the propagules, the derived propagules have a highly significantly reduced growth with respect to the baseline data. So that leaves only one possible conclusion. That is that the fittest groups have evolved the capacity to transition rapidly through different states of the life cycle. And I'll leave that, because I've got a series of summary graphs here. Okay, this is what happened, believe it or not, in this experiment. So what this shows are all the relevant parameters that we measured during the course of this experiment. Let's just look at this set here. We've got a set of circles that are, in this case and in this case, exactly the same size. These are both our baseline data sets. Here is a measure of collective fitness, the capacity of groups to beget groups. Here is a measure of the number of wrinkly spreaders, a lower cell level parameter. Measure of cell fitness, which is the total number of cells in our populations. This is the number of smooth cells. This is the rate of growth, Vmax, of our smooth cells. This is the transition likelihood between wrinkly spreader and smooth. Red arrows with red lines indicate a positive correlation. If there is an arrow, there is a regression, so a much more positive connection. So, for example, if we want to know right from the outset, in terms of what selection had to work with, if before evolution took place on this, we could see that collective fitness is determined largely, at least in the control, this is where we're going rinky to rinky, by the number of rinky spreaders. So the number of rinky spreaders is causally related to collective fitness. Total number of cells also positively correlates, well, that's a positive regression with collective fitness. There are some negative regressions to it as well. Okay. This is where we end up with after now 10 generations of evolution. This is where we've just gone from that to that to that. First of all, you can see changes in the sizes of some of these circles, either larger or smaller. And what we're really trying to explain here is collective fitness and to get a sense of what lower level properties explain collective level fitness. And here we can see, where we saw no evidence of fitness decoupling, that collective fitness is explained by an increase, an improvement in collective fitness is explained by an improvement in cell level fitness. And we could just leave it at that. There is no connection between transition probability and collective fitness. Everything has to do with basically improvement in the growth of the cooperating rinky spreader type. Now that's very different when we go down here and we look at the blood cycle. So here, where the lower level properties, smooth growth rate, cell fitness, and number of rinky spreaders greatly increased and explain collective level fitness, that is not the case here. In fact, there's been a reduction in the smooth growth rate, a reduction in the total number of rinky spreaders, a reduction in total cell fitness. There's been an increase in the number of smooths, but that is not explained by an increase in growth rate. Explained by transition probability. Transition probability here explains the increase in collective fitness. And arguably, transition probability is a product of selection acting at the level of groups and not at the level of the known cells. So, here we go, some conclusions. Well, here we established a set of ecological conditions necessary for selection both within and between groups. They involved selection regime that saw possibilities to act on a proto-developmental cycle as one way of incorporating selection on cooperation, but at least relaxing the focus of selection so it's not just on cooperation, it becomes the focus of a property of an emerging organism. We see in this life cycle regime evidence of fitness being decoupled. We no longer can explain the fitness at the higher level on the basis of fitness at the lower. For our control, where we went from mat to mat to mat, arguably just selected on the lower level, cooperative ability of lower level entities, we see group fitness improving as a cross-level byproduct of property of fitness, not as a direct consequence of the property of the group itself. In the life cycle regime, however, group fitness appears to be a direct consequence of transition probability of the group level trait. So the way I've been thinking about this is, from the perspective of explaining Darwinian transitions in individuality, in particular, explaining how a collective evolves the capacity to lead collective offspring. And you saw the schematic earlier on. The idea was that if we could select on some property of the group that approximated a proto-developmental cycle, then perhaps we could set about endowing individuality on the higher level collective. And if we could, then one could imagine that this would bring about fitness decoupling, but more to the point, allow opportunity for the evolution of all those collective level traits that must indeed evolve eventually if a transition in individuality is to come anywhere near what we see in the extant life forms around us. Of course, once we start seeing fitness decoupling, but along with this comes emergence, not in any fanciful way, but simply in the sense that we can no longer explain the fitness of the collective on the basis of the fitness of the lower level entities. And as I said a moment ago, once we have these emergent groups, then one can imagine opportunities for evolution of these far more complex, but nonetheless group level traits. And behind all of this is ecology, And I really do think, as I mentioned before, that the ecological circumstances under which such transitions might take place perhaps present the most profound challenge, more so than the genetic ones that we would perhaps initially think are the most important. So once again, my collaborators on this dimension, particularly the heroines Caroline and Katrin. Thank you.
Well, I was wondering, is it possible that once you've evolved, what you have in the final stage is not actually genetic mutation between two states, but essentially your bed edges?
Yeah, exactly. So I don't, I sort of skipped over in the interest. Exactly. What is going on there? So we haven't taken them apart genetically at all, but the transition, the transition rates are so ridiculously high that that's all I can account for. And in fact, we've done a little genetics behind it.
But that means that there isn't really a germline somatic distinction. It's just a single cell type that's choosing two different phenotypes.
That's right. I mean, this is how it proceeds. At this stage, I saw the opportunity for selection to work at a higher level if there was opportunity for reproduction. How it might play out, I'm not sure at the end of the day. A desirable situation would be that this life cycle does come under development and control, whether it leads to a soma germline distinction, so it's not clear. But of course, if it does come under development and control, that would be an exception. And I could imagine a scenario in the not too distant future, if we continue this on, where you could, by virtue of this extreme gradient across the boundary of the map from top and bottom, in terms of oxygen concentration, coupling an oxygen-sensitive regulator to a gene that controls, genes that control the expression of glue, such that when there's plenty of oxygen, you produce the glue. When there's not oxygen, so the underside of the mat, the glue is switched off and the cells swim away again. I mean, in many ways, this would be not so far-fetched as from a Dick D'Estelian or a Mitsoklokas type of social behavior.
So this is kind of at the general level, because you sort of set up multicellularity as aggregation of individuals. But is it not possible, because I was thinking like a cell might secrete a proteoglycan, for example, to protect itself. But similarly, a cell might secrete another cell to protect itself. Might not that be the origin of multicellularity?
Could be, absolutely. I mean, as I said before, there are many possible routes for the origin of multicellularity. When you sit down and you think about how multicellularity emerges and how soma germline distinction and so on emerges, and you start thinking mechanistically about it, it's not so straightforward. But yes, there are many possible ways by which this could, and by no means is a life cycle coming about like this. I mean, this may be completely an artifact of the laboratory environment and have no relevance outside of this context whatsoever. But I think there is something, though, I think that evolutionary transitions, certainly to multicellularity, are very much about the evolution of collective level reproduction. And that tends to be via a life cycle. So how life cycles comes about, to me, is quite a central issue. And I can imagine a variety of different ways by which life cycles come about.
Paul, I must admit, I'm lost and I'm confused. So I wonder, once a propagule is evolved, like a transition from wrinkly to a smooth has taken place, if we assume that the propagule is the fittest in the environment, why this fittest wants to have something like a pragmatic approach or contingency to still now evolve or flip between two different states? So a red one goes back and produces a wrinkly.
Why would it want to do that?
If it's fittest, if I assume it has a selective advantage in the new environment, why it would like to go back to the original state from where it evolved, which was unfit?
Well, its fitness is relative and frequency dependent. So when a cooperating type comes common,
actually boosts its fitness advantage, the environment changes to one that favors the other type, let's say the cheat. When the cheat becomes common, it kills the group, and it loses its advantage. And via this cycling, it's a constant play out of tragedy of the commons, as someone was mentioning the other day. So fitness is changing all the time depending upon the circumstances. So each organism is changing its environment, changing the selective conditions that favor the other type. So that's why it keeps cycling.
The environment does not remain the same like when you have that. You start from a single cell, which is friendly, and you select the all the propagules, then re-inoculate in an environment. So then the first environment and second, they are not the same?
Those two environments are exactly the same, but the organisms do different things to them. So when you put in the wrinkly spread of the cell, it's up there. That point, it's on its own. It's the only genotype that's in there. But by virtue of it forming that mat, it establishes the selective conditions that will see the evolution, whether I like it or not, of cheating types. That happens because being a member of this group is costly. Selection will reward types that don't pay that cost but reap the benefit from the group. So we then simply collect the cheating propagules, put those into the fresh microcosm, and there those cells are very happy to begin with, but they deplete the oxygen, and that leads to the conditions that will favor once again mutant types that can colonize the air liquid interface and thus gain access to oxygen.
Can I phrase it like, so organism is changing the ecology, which is then basically
feeding back,
having the
yeah, exactly.
It's not the ecology putting some selective pressure on a...
No, the organisms are modifying their environment, and the organisms are then evolving to meet the requirements of that modified environment. So it's very much an example of niche construction and ecosystem engineering.
And I didn't understand, how do you always think that the accumulation of mutation can lead to this phenomena, but there are chances that...
I can't, it's coming and going.
Okay, the question is, maybe I'll...
Just tell me a little bit more what you're thinking.
Well, the question seems to be, how do you get back and forth movement in this system when your mutations accumulating? Are you reverting all of them?
No, you're not reverting all of them. Many mutations will take you down a path from which there's no recovery, and we see that by the very large scale extinction probability. So many mutations take you to a position you can't get out of. What then happens? We haven't done enough genetics on this yet. We're just beginning to take this apart. Certainly there are build-up of mutations, and you can't have these accumulating indefinitely. In the lines that have learned to evolve to transition between these different stages of the life cycle most rapidly, they've almost certainly, given the rates that we can see, they're doing it via some bistable epigenetic kind of mechanism. So of course those are now removed from build-up of pleiotropic mutation, potentially deleterious effects. How do we distinguish it? We use a neutral lac Z marker.
And it doesn't need... I'm just trying to understand that whether the
lac Z
can add to it to revert back to...
No, definitely. Well, actually, what we do is we measure both derived and baseline relative to a lac Z marked strain. So baseline to lac Z, derived to lac Z, and then we express them as a ratio to both. And we can distinguish easily the LACZ ancestral type on blue, basis of blue colour from either of the other lines.